Blog Talk Radio.
To independence now.
Yeah, they say those who do not move do not feel their chains, but the African people aware of their pain, aware of the game, invader deception, black presidents who are white man extensions, people from Cape to Cairo rebel, cause fake independence and ongoing hell, colonial ties still keep them chained, the richest continents getting robbed again, the IMF and World Bank criminal schemes, what about reparations? To me it seems that every metropole from Amsterdam to Paris and Brussels was built with the hands of African labor, a slave relation, developing Europe at expense of their nation. But Africans rebel from the first conquest till flag independence at last accomplished.
Il y en a qui demandent de tout l'impérialisme. L'impérialisme, regardez dans vos assiettes, quand vous mangez les grains de riz, de maïs, de mil importés. C'est ça l'impérialisme, n'allez pas plus loin.
Yeah. Ayo, the spirit of Lumumba lives on in Congo, like Thomas Sankara in Burkina Faso. Samora Michelle, it was Viva Frelimo, but Mozambique still fighting for freedom. Why did these three who dare to invent the future then clash to the fullest extent with the colonizers? If we open eyes, if we can see the rich whites, we're scared of rising African power, real independence, a people's politics, anti-capitalism. So they stifle their growth in every way, so that South Africa looks colonized today. For any flaws of Mugabe, that ain't what they hate. Zimbabwe's not a colony, make no mistake. Look at AFRICOM, the African command. That's the US and a puppet shaking each other's hands. Divide and conquer is a hell of a tactic. They blame Africa for relations that backward. The whole basis was plunder from outside Rwanda, Uganda. The Sudan's divides, pushing forward war for precious coal sand. So cell phones and PCs are sold in lands where people don't know how they were constructed. Your Windows now functions from a child's destruction.
Revolutionary greetings. Thank you for tuning in with Jewel Seeds radio show this evening for another Black August edition. So it is myself, Sister Rue, also known as Ifatu Miche, and we do have the host, the regular host for this show on this evening with us, Sister Latoya, also known as Jua, and we also have one of the brothers on with us this evening, Brother Moisey. So all of y'all lines are open. If y'all wanted to say anything right now.
I'm Jumbo.
See Jumbo.
Peace and love. Good afternoon.
So,
peace and love. Revolutionary greetings to everyone. Black August salute.
Black August salute. So we felt like for this August, we were going to focus on many aspects of resistance. So we also felt like we needed to focus more on some of the plights of the Black woman for Black August, because it's a lot of resistance that's happening every day in our community, and a lot of people probably don't look at these acts of revolutionary as these acts as being revolutionary. Our first guest speaker who will be coming on shortly is a sister that I met a couple of years back. Her name is Sister Tanja Green. She's going to be bringing us information to discuss the critical role of birth workers in the Black community. Because as we know, Black women have the highest We have the highest infant mortality rate when our children are born. We have the highest death rate after birth. So it's definitely something major that's happening within the medical community that a lot of people are not talking about. So we felt like it's important to discuss this type of thing and to discuss how black women are resisting what's happening. The other guest speaker, Sister Tashia Richards, she'll be discussing racial disparities and foster care and the need for more black foster parents, which is also a revolutionary act. Saving ourselves, being advocates for ourselves, and being advocates for our children and taking our children, providing housing for our children and loving our children when they don't have homes to go to, these are revolutionary acts. When we talk about, like, resistance, most people automatically think of, being at war as far as in the physical aspect and engaging with, physical combat or having weapons, that type of thing. But they don't think of resisting in this type of aspect. But it's important. So before we bring the sisters on, we want to let Brother Moisey give us the information about why this day in Black August is important and is one of the flea days. So he's going to give us the information on what this flea day represents.
And I'm in full agreement with everything that you said, sister, and I think in a lot of ways that can be connected to the brothers who are being commemorated for this 13th of August, Flea Day. This Flea Day, we are remembering the contributions and the ultimate sacrifice of Dree Ndugu from the California State Prison System, being W.L. Nolan, Cleveland Edwards, and Alvin Miller, who made a name for themselves for taking it, into their own hands to reform their mentalities and to become what many refer to as, prison house revolutionaries. W.L. Nolan, to many of us, is known as one of the chief educators and examples for George Jackson. And, a lot of his activity contributed to some of the openings for black people in the California prison system, one of which was the ability to get access to fresh air. A lot of people might not know that California prisons, brothers didn't have access to the outside yard. That was a right reserved for white people. And it was through that struggle that he ultimately lost his life in the very yard that he fought to get him and brothers like himself out to be able to breathe, fresh, clean air. And on this particular day, those three brothers and others were basically engaged in physical combat against members of the Aryan Brotherhood. And it was a correctional officer by the name of OBG Miller, who was known for being a good rifle shot, and he murdered those three brothers in cold blood, and the only three people that he took aim at. So today we remember their sacrifice, and if I can say anything in relationship to the topic today, is the struggle that they were forced to have to wage inside of prison in a lot of ways is being prepared early in our youth through those statistics that you pointed out just now, Sister Russo. If we want to contribute to putting an end to our brothers and sisters losing their lives in these prison institutions, what a lot of my comrades refer to as concentration camps, it definitely does start with us taking control of, our community in the sense of being able to provide housing, and love for our children.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Exactly. Thank you for that. Thank you for that. So, on a, can you tell like more about the flea day? Like, you know, as far as like the details of what you do on a flea day.
Oh, okay. So, today, all over this country, everybody who is commemorating those three individuals for this flea day, there are four flea days, the 1st, 7th, the 13th, and 21st. And on each flea day, we sacrifice food for 24 hours. We work out every 5 hours. And really, we just rededicate our physical and spiritual being to, you know, channeling those struggles that ended up in the assassination of the brothers who are remembered and soon to be sister. I'm excited about that.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't really been given the liberty to, you know, put it out there. So, but all I will say is I'm excited for next year's Black August. You know, for us to be able to remember a strong and just a Goliath sister in this struggle. So, but yeah, so 24-hour fast, 5 workouts every 6 hours. You know, workout every 6 hours, equaling 5 a day. And study, not just about, you know, the physical aspect, as the sister said, it's definitely an emotional, spiritual, mental war that's being waged against us. And, you know, the sooner we are able to realize the place we have in this society and our position in the world, you know, the sooner we can start getting down to producing the work that's going to be able to liberate us as a people. So shout out to everybody who is in the foster care system, everybody who is in, you know, this educational system that's not treating them or teaching them right. Everybody around the country, man, and around the globe that's struggling for their basic human rights.
Mm-hmm. I sure. So I'm going to tell you all, and thank you for that, brother. I'm going to tell you all a little bit about the sister, Miss Tanja Green. I met her a few years ago. We took the birth worker course together at Mama Toto Village in D.C. She's a beautiful sister. I noticed, like, when I first met her, she was so well organized, and she really motivated me to be more organized while we were taking a class. I don't think I ever told her that, but she's really motivating. Like, you know, she got herself together, and she said, I'm going to stick with this, and I knew that it was something that I would probably do on the side, but she was like, yeah, I'm going to stick with this, and I see that she has, and I'm just, you know, I think it's so beautiful. But I'm going to say a little bit about her. She is a birth and postpartum doula who loves all things mommy and baby. She is affectionately known as the fourth trimester doula, specializing in postpartum and newborn care. She has been in the birth services field for almost 6 years, and she loves every moment that she gets to be there for her clients and their families. She's also a life coach, looking forward to helping women who have gone through a divorce to find their voice and learn to turn their pain into passion. That's beautiful. She is also a mother of two young men, Devin and Jordan Delaney. So I'm going to unmute her line so that she can give us this good information about how critical her role is and other birth workers' role is in the community So, all right, Sister Tanja, are you here?
Yes, ma'am. I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Thank you.
Okay, okay. Hello, hello. Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us this evening. We know how critical it is, and we need to share this information. So if you would like to tell us, and even though it's 2019, a lot of people don't know what a birth worker, some people say doula, a lot of people have not heard those terms before, and that says a lot within itself. But if you could just, you know, give us like a description of your role as a birth worker.
Okay, I certainly will be glad to do that. So my role as a birth worker or a doula, also known as a birth companion, and some people look at it as a birth coach as well, we are non-medical companions who support women while they are birthing, providing them care, continuous care during and after their childbirth. And we do that providing them with information, physical support, and emotional support. We also provide them support as far as with their family and with their partners. And we're different from midwives because a lot of people always ask, are you a midwife? And I'm not. I'm like, no, I'm not a midwife. And where we are different from midwives is that we are not medical professionals, and so we cannot administer medical medication, and we don't do anything to support the mom and her family and to help her get through her birthing experience and then to be there to support her after birth.
Right. And you said you've been doing it for almost 6 years?
Yes, that's correct.
So, but your focus is, so it's, they say they call you, you said they call you the fourth trimester. The fourth trimester doula? Because
yes,
you specialize in care after postpartum?
Yes, I do. So when I first did my training, as we did together at Mama Toto Village back in, I want to say back in 2015. Wow, it seems like crazy, but back in 2015, we did our training. We were, you know, we learned to be labor and postpartum doulas. And I absolutely love both. I've attended births as well as attended with my clients postpartum. But I became more drawn to postpartum because I felt like for me that that was the best place for me to be, to hold the space for that mother when she comes home from the hospital. Because a lot of them, when they come home from the hospital, they are trying to process their birth experience, whether they had a C-section, whether they had vaginal birth, whether it was if the labor was long and enduring, if they had any issues with their doctors or their OBGYN, they just come home with so much. So when they come home having to heal, having to bond with their baby, having to get back into life, I felt like that was the best place for me. So that's why I chose to let my focus be on the aftercare and the postpartum.
Right. So let me ask you something. When it comes down to the postpartum, have you ran into, like, families who in the beginning really don't see the importance of your role and then maybe later realize the importance of it?
You know what, I do actually, and I run into it more in our community, which is why I'm so big on trying to educate my community on the importance of a postpartum doula. But I do run into it more. A lot of them, they do not see the value in having a postpartum doula. A lot of them, the first thing they say is, oh, I don't have anybody there to help me take care of my baby. And I always have to say, you know, we're not there to take care of the baby. I'm actually there to take care of you because you're the one that needs the care.
Right.
And a lot of them, if they haven't had one, and then what they do is they may hear about a postpartum. Somebody else may have had a postpartum doula, and when they hear about it, they will say, oh, you know what, I guess I should have gotten it. You know, they kind of feel a certain way about having it because a lot of them feel like, you know, they feel like if they have somebody there helping them that they're not worthy or, you know, you're taking away their role. Or they feel bad because it's like somebody's here helping me and I don't need that. So that's why a lot of them were really turned down having a postpartum doula. What they don't realize is what we do is that we also provide them with resources. We help them with, you know, breastfeeding support. We allow mom to get that rest and that sleep, which is what she needs. We help them out with little things, even around the house, helping them around the house. We nurture them and the family as well with questions, anything about the baby. And we're just mainly there to hold that space for that mom. A lot of people don't realize is that when a woman comes home from having a baby, there's a whole lot of things going on. Her hormones are, you know, a little off. She just had a baby. She's just processing so much. And it is good to have somebody that can help hold that space for you while you're healing and letting you know that it's okay. And if you're feeling a certain kind of way, it's okay, and I'm going to help you do that.
Right. That's beautiful. And I know, like, I was wondering if you have worked with different cultures that, I know, like, for our culture, like you were saying, a lot of people feel like it's taking away something from them or making them maybe feel like if they have a postpartum doula, it may be some type of insinuation that they're not able to do an adequate job at home, you know what I mean, or something
mm-hmm.
like that. But I know, like, some cultures, it's different. Like, they're not expected to, you know, they are expecting that heavy support system. Like, that's normal. But for us,
mm-hmm.
because of the superwoman, I'm going to just say, like, the superwoman syndrome, where we so used to having to do so much and to just deal with it however we deal with it, even though we overwhelmed and stuff, a lot of us, you know, it's just like passed down. You might get some help
mm-hmm.
if you have a mom that's local. You might get some help, or, you know, a grandmom that's local, they might come and stay for a couple of weeks or the first week or something. But it's not, you know, it's not much more than that. And a lot of people don't even want that because they just feel like, I need to be strong and I just need to do this by myself. This is my child, you know, the dad is here, even though he might be at work or whatever during the day, but this is something that I need to do for myself. Do you run into, like, other cultures that accept it?
Yes, now I would say that, yes, now 90% of my clientele, because I do have my business where I run my postpartum doula business, 90% of my clientele are other cultures, are you know, white, Asians, other cultures. That's 90% of my clients
wow.
that seek out for our service. Now, I will tell you, when you go sit down and talk to them, for one, they have already done their research, and so they definitely see the value in having a postpartum doula. A lot of the families, they have seen postpartum depression in their family, so they've seen their mothers go through it. Maybe their, you know, their grandmothers, or they've been told that this, you know, has been in our family, and so they already know that you're going to need some help. But they do not hesitate to sign up for the service, to get the service, and then they may have you anywhere from 2 weeks to 6 months at a time, because for them, it's important. They see it as a needed value benefit in their home, because for one, sleep is very important to them, and sleep deprivation is the number one aid to postpartum depression, which a lot of people don't understand. That if you're not getting at night and you're constantly up, and then during the day you gotta get with your baby, that sleep deprivation at some point is mm-hmm. going to get to you, and it's going to start to bother you. You're going to get irritated, and you're going to get depressed because you're going to be feeling like, I just can't do a whole lot. So for them, they will gladly sign up for a service. They, you know, they never give any pushback. Like I said, it's never really a whole lot of questions. They've already done their research. Normally, when they reach out to you, they pretty much already want the service. They just want to know how much you charge, if you're available, and, you know, if you're going to, you know, the duration of the time that you can be there to help them and their family.
Right. So.
And I had wanted
so
to.
Like,
oh,
based
I'm sorry.
On,
go ahead.
I'm sorry.
And I was just going to say, I wanted to piggyback off what you said about, you know, in our community, you know, the stigma of the superwoman syndrome that we normally have. You know, statistics are showing that 20% of women develop a prenatal mental health illness, which is depression, anxiety, compulsive disorder behavior, even postpartum psychosis. They develop that, and they even get it during pregnancy, and it can come up to a year after pregnancy. A lot of people don't realize that. Your baby just because my soul don't mean that you have it. So for Black women, a lot of times, you know, we take the risk by not, you know, reaching out and getting that. Or we think that we don't have depression, and a lot of people don't know how to recognize some of the signs. And I've heard a lot of mothers say that The reason why they will not get a postpartum doula is because they feel like, as a parent, you know, there's that stigma. You know, oh, they're going to think I'm a bad parent because I hired somebody to help me. Or my peers are going to think, you know, that I'm a weak, you know, that I'm weak and I can't take care of my family. And then, of course, how we were raised, you know, we were raised that you take care of everything. Like you said, you come home, you cook, you clean, you take care, you go to work, you do all those things. You shouldn't need anybody to help you. And, of course, even in the faith community, you know, the faith community always says, you know, pray about it and, you know, you're God or God or, you know, whoever they believe in, what, you know, take care of it. And it's like, no, you can do those things, but you do still need to help. And, you know, and we're having family and friends around us that make us feel bad for that. You know, I've even heard one lady say her, you know, she was told that she was bougie and she was going to get her postpartum doula. And I was like, you got to get to the point where, you know, you stop listening to everybody else and you have to do what's best for you. I can tell you one of the main setbacks for a lot of people in our community is usually the money. Now, this service is by, you know, by far, it's not a cheap service. It's a value service, but it's not cheap. Uh-huh. And I normally, when I talk to people, I normally tell them that one of the things you can do to kind of help you out is when you have your baby shower, you know, put on your gift registry, postpartum doula, labor doula, and ask people to donate to your doula.
That's right.
If they're going to buy you a gift, ask them to donate to your doula fund and say, look, I'm going to need me a doula for 6 months as a shower gift. Can you donate $20 or donate however much you want to bless me with so that I can have a doula because I need to be healthy after my baby is born.
That's exactly. I was just thinking the same thing. Like, I don't have any children, but I was just thinking, if I have a child, that is where, like, I would want to let my family and friends invest. If y'all want to invest, you know, because when a child is born, for real, we be getting a lot of unnecessary stuff for people. You know they need diapers, and we know they need, you know, certain things. But when it comes to the clothes and the shoes, the, you know, like expensive shoes and stuff like that, a lot of people willing to invest a lot of money into material things that the baby is not necessarily going to even need or maybe use a couple of times. But I want to, you know, like if I have a child, I'm going to need to be like, yeah, my baby don't need no bunch of name brand stuff. But if you want to invest in something, you can invest in our well-being. And
exactly.
Like, yeah, when you said, know that the, you know, the socioeconomic status of people plays a role in everything that we do, but at the same time, by your clientele being 90% other than African American women, like it's plenty of African American families that are doing really well for themselves, but it's just a cultural thing where we're not used to having assistance with, you know, like what we're talking about. We're not really used to it. It hasn't been normalized. So
right.
It's coming out more and more. You know, we're getting more educated and we're getting more used to hearing the terminology and, you know, used to seeing people that they have doulas and, you know, stuff like that. But even the ones that can't afford it, a lot of times they just, you know, it's a culture thing. We just really not that open to it as we should be.
Exactly. And which is why I definitely, which is my goal is to get out there and to really educate, you know, our culture. I want to educate all women, but to educate our culture especially, just to, you know, educate them on it and let them see the value of it. And, you know, and like I say, I tell people, you know, there are all ways around it. You know, even if you don't have the money up front, there are, you know, doulas, different businesses that, you know, they have payment plans, you know, like I say, you know, have that as a baby shower gift. You know, and I'm a firm believer that, you know, at the end of the day, I'm a firm believer. I've been there and done that where I wouldn't pay for certain things because, you know, you pay for what you want. You pay for what you value and what's important. And the most important thing is to get that information out to them to let them know that this is important. Your health is important. When you bring that baby home, your health, your well-being, your mental is important. And, you know, you need that care just to help you. Even if you do a 72-hour package, I have a 72-hour package, you know, from the hospital in the first 3 days. If I can help you get through the first 3 days just to get yourself settled and get your mind right, you know, that is good. Just because, you know, I just think, you know, it's important and it's something that's needed. And like you say, it's a mindset change. I had a client who told me that her family, you know, completely, and she was black and her family was completely against it. Even though they were against her breastfeeding. So So they were really just, their mindset about everything was just way left. But they got on her, you know, why are you breastfeeding? You shouldn't be doing that. You should be bottle feeding. Why you need a postpartum doula? You should be good. And she had just had twins, and she also had a four-year-old. So in her mind,
mom
she was like, no, I need this.
About the breastfeeding. She definitely needed it. She needed all the education and assistance that she could get. But I noticed that, like, we have to study for everything. Like, you know, if we go buy a car, we're going to want to go online and we're going to want to Google the reviews about this car. We're going to want to test drive it. We're going to want to find out how this car operates. Like everything that we involve ourselves in, before we make any major decisions with our partners, with our families, with stuff like buying homes, buying cars, with what field we're gonna study in life, what career path we're gonna take, we do research on it. But for some reason, when it comes to parenting, giving birth, going through a pregnancy, a lot of people feel like it's a learn-as-you-go experience. Can't nobody really teach me much about this. I just gotta learn as I go. And so, you know what I'm saying? It's just because that's what we've been taught. You figure it out as you go along, and that's not the case. Like, it's so much education about pregnancy, birth, postpartum that we lack in. And we don't even realize we lacking it.
Yeah, I can be honest in saying that y'all blowing my mind with this stuff. I've never even considered it. And I have to say, sister, like that idea of using baby showers to contribute to the mental health of the mother is a brilliant idea. I'm like, I've heard. I've only been to like one baby shower before. It's not really a thing that young boys like to go to, but I've certainly heard of many, and I've never heard a conversation around baby showers centering around the mental or even physical health of the mother. Like it's mind-boggling for me now at this point in my development and listening to this conversation that I guess that the community of women doesn't consider that as also being a contributing factor to the mental and physical health of the child. That's deep, man. That's really deep, and I appreciate being here right now. Yeah, this you're teaching me something, because I've never thought about that. I've never even considered the physical and mental toll of childbearing on sisters. So. I'm definitely in school right now.
We happy to have you. So
yes.
the thing about like when we took the birth worker course, I started feeling like all of my sisters, all of my homegirls, all of my family, I started feeling like they have been robbed of the proper birthing experience and the proper prenatal education, because I was just like, wow, like really, you learn so much that you've never heard of. And you know, I'm almost 40 now, so I was in my mid-30s taking this birth worker course, and I was like, I mean, I at the time I didn't even know we had the highest infant mortality rate. I didn't know that we had the highest death rate after birth, after giving birth, which they were saying, they did the studies on and everything, and they were thinking that, okay, it's just the mom that's in the predominantly black neighborhoods that might not have proper access, adequate access to certain types of medical care and stuff like that, or might live in food deserts where, you know, they don't have access to as healthy food as other people, don't have transportation. But then when they were deeper into the study, it still showed that even the wealthier black women have higher death rates after birth and have higher infant mortality rates. So it wasn't about socioeconomic status only. It's about us being in America, period, in this racist environment that takes a toll on us in pregnancy and takes a toll on us postpartum. So
yeah,
that blew my mind away. Mm-hmm.
Right, and you know, and it's also about yeah, and I would say to also, if you know, it's the education and knowing and knowing your rights when you go into the hospital and when it comes to birth, and you know, being able to have somebody there with you to help you advocate for yourself. I know I didn't have that when I had my baby, and to know your rights, to know what you can do. You know, they go into the hospitals and they're told you can't do this and you can't do that. And a lot of it is a bunch of, you know, bull. No, you can do this, you can do that. You know, and just mm-hmm. having that person there to say, listen, this is our plan. Go in with a birth plan, and this is what we're going to do. If A happens, we're going to do this. If B happens, we're going to do this. And like I said, just being educated and knowing your rights, knowing the birth plan, knowing how everything works in the birth process, so that when they go there, they can have these preventive measures from happening. And then having someone there that if you say something's wrong with you, not only is your partner there to say it, but you also have your doula there to say it. I've heard so many stories where, you know, women, especially black women, go in and have, you know, they go in and have their babies. And you know, and they're like, look, something is wrong. And the nurses and doctors are like, no, you're fine. They're like, no, something is wrong. And then come to find out something was wrong, and had they not said anything and caught it, you know, they wouldn't be here today.
Right, because that happened, just happened to Serena Williams, right?
Yep.
So that just goes to show, like we were just talking about, you can be filthy rich, but you, when you go into those hospitals, you still a black woman.
Yep.
So a lot of your complaints are going to go ignored. They feel like we have a higher tolerance for pain. They ignore a lot of our complaints and signs and symptoms until the last minute. And that's how a lot of us are dying, giving birth and, you know, dying after birth, just simply because we're being ignored. We're being ignored while we're, like, screaming for help.
And also, question, with the doulas or the birth workers, wouldn't that decrease the chances of, like, cesareans and then how they're given the epidurals and then, you know, all of the after effects after having your baby in the hospital, you know, to bring on the postpartum and the ailment on our life? When you're home and the mother is having, you know, issues like that, so do you do natural remedies to try to help stimulate the mom? Is that some of the things that you do as a birth worker or a doula?
Yes. There are some things that we do for the mom to help them not have to run into those problems. I've had moms that have had natural, non-medicated births. And the things they did, you know, their diet played a part in it. You know, the things that they did before preparing, the education that they had, even something as simple as when they would go into labor, a lot of my moms when I was doing labor would stay home and birth primarily at home as long as they could. I usually say 5-1-1, you know, wait until your contractions are coming every 5 minutes, you know, and it's been doing that for an hour, and they're spread apart and then go to the hospital, because a lot of moms get that white coat syndrome when they go in the hospital. They see a doctor, everything changes. So there are things that we do put in place to kind of help them to avoid those things. Education is a big, big key. We educate our moms. We teach them as much as we can. They get as much as they can from us, and then we arm them with all of the knowledge that they need, so when they do go in there, they know that, you know, I can do this, I can do that, I don't have to do this, I don't have to do that, and make them comfortable.
Okay, thank you so much.
Can you give us, Sister Sandra, can you give us an example where you had to advocate for one of the moms in the hospital?
Yes, I most certainly can. My very first labor client that I had after we graduated, I had my very first labor client. She was having her baby. It had been 10 years since she had her first child, and her first child she had her via cesarean. So This time around, she wanted to do a VBAC, which is having a baby vaginal after you've had a cesarean. So when we went into the hospital, the first thing they told her when they read her chart was that they just automatically told her you're going to have a cesarean because you had one already, which was not true. And so they had already gotten my client kind of uptight because she was just like, I really do want to have a VBAC, and they're telling me that I can't. So, you know, after, you know, calming her down and working with her through, you know, her contractions and everything, they just kept coming in and wanting her to sign these papers, and they were very adamant about her having a C-section. I will tell you that one of the things that affected is that she was on the Medicaid plan, and so when we go in with those clients, they definitely treat them different. As soon as they see your chart, it's automatically like they kind of put you in a certain section. And so they just kept doing that to her and telling her that. And her labor was long. I mean, it had been 10 years, but she was having a VBAC. After a certain amount of hours, they were telling her things like, you know, failure to progress. And that's the word that a mother does not want to hear, failure to progress when she's in labor, because you're basically telling her that her body has failed her. You cannot do this. And so they kept coming in saying, oh, your body is failing to progress. You cannot have this baby. We need to have a C-section. After a certain amount of hours, they were getting really agitated because, of course, for them, they want you to come in and have a baby and be done so they can move on. But we kept going at it. We had a plan. And our plan was is that we're going to have this baby as long as you're good and nothing is happening to you. And so, you know, they just kept coming in. And eventually she ended up having the baby vaginal. What ended up happening was we had to call in the medical advocacy because they were just really getting carried away with their language and things that they were doing. But the midwives ended up coming in and taking over. And when the midwives had came in and took over, within a matter of maybe an hour, she had labored for about 13 plus hours. Within a matter of hours, when the midwives had put the doctors and the OBGYs out, they came in and she had that baby vaginal.
And then they get more money for the cesarean.
They do. It's a business.
Oh, really?
So they definitely always want C-section because they get more money for that.
And Northern Virginia is one of the – Northern Virginia has one of the highest rates in the whole country for cesarean rate, for doing C-sections. And some of it is unnecessary. Of course, we know, you know, things happen and it just has to be done sometimes. But their intervention rate is really high, and they have like one of the worst rates in the whole country. And I was working with a mom once, and I knew, I said, man, she lives in Northern Virginia, she lives in Fairfax. I said, they're gonna try to get her to do a C-section. I was like, I know it. So her doctor kind of slung it on her real easy on one visit, like he kind of mentioned it, but you know, not too much, just threw it out there like an option. But she wasn't even having any issues. But the closer she got to her due date, they kept talking about it, But she wouldn't do it. But they really wanted her to. And I was like, they want to get that money. And it's you know, it's less time consuming for them because you never know how short or how long the birthing experience is going to be. Somebody might, you know, like you just said, she was in there for 13 hours. It may be a short birth, it may be a long birthing experience. So they don't want to deal with that. They just want, okay, what time we going to schedule her for Tuesday at 10 o'clock, boom, boom, then we're going to get her out. That's what they prefer. It's more money and it's more time efficient for them.
That's exactly what they do, and it's sad because so many women have had C-sections, and I could probably, if I had to bet on it, guarantee that a lot of them didn't even have a C-section. What a lot of people don't realize is that I tell my clients all the time is that birthing is a process. When you're in labor, it's a process. It is not a short process, and your body has to labor. So, you know, it could be anywhere from 2 hours in labor. It could be anywhere up to 20-plus hours in labor, but your body has to labor. I did have a client who her doctor scheduled her a C-section, baby number 3, and she wanted to do a VBAC, and her doctor had scheduled a C-section. She was very determined she wasn't going to have one, so she didn't go. She didn't show up at the hospital. Now, she did have her baby 4 days later. Her water broke and everything, and she had her baby vaginal. But he was mad at her because he had scheduled it, and she was like, I'm not coming. She was like, I told you, either you get on board with what I want to do or don't, you just won't birth my baby.
Right, because
so
they
like,
be
you know,
trying to go on vacations and.
Mm-hmm. They be trying to strong arm ladies, which is why, you know, one of the good things about having a doula is because they were strong armed. And when a woman gets to a point where she's feeling defeated and she's feeling like she has no more to give, then, you know, we step in and we kind of talk her through that. And we're like, no, if this is what you want, we're going to do this.
That's right. That's right.
And
it's tough.
Thank you for being there for that, sister. It's, this is making some things a little more real for me. I actually had two questions, right? But I think one of them might not have nothing to do with the first. But before the show started, I wrote down a question for you. Some people don't realize the first definition of genocide had like four parts to it. And two of those were being causing serious bodily harm or mental harm to members of a group and imposing measures, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. And I wasn't sure if I wanted to ask you this question, but hearing the two stories that you just gave, do you feel like there's a deliberate neglect for the well-being of particularly black women when they enter hospitals? Or do you feel like there's just a general uncaring for them? Like, do you think that they're doing this purposefully, or they're just not doing the best job when they see us?
I would go with the latter, the genuine care and concern for us, because I've seen attitudes change. I've been in where I've seen, the other cultures go in and how they get treated, and I've seen how we get treated. And it's the genuine lack of care and concern for us and our feelings, because, first of all, when we come in, they think that we don't know what we're talking about. So I have, clients that go in and they'll say certain things to the doctor, like, I do not want you to cut the cord into the placenta without pulsating. And the nurses and the doctors always give them this look like, well, how do you know about that? Like, what do you know about that? And, you know what I mean? She's looking like, yes, she does know exactly what that means, you know. But they just have this sense that, you know, that we're not deserving of the best care, that we shouldn't get that kind of care, and that we should do exactly what they're saying. We don't know what we're talking about. And, you know, as if we're just not supposed to be there. And it's kind of like, you know, it's a little disheartening when I see that, because I feel like, you know, everybody deserves the best care. If I'm here in this hospital, I don't care if I have Medicaid. I don't care if I have the best, you know, medical insurance that's in town. Everybody deserves to get the best care when they're in the hospital having their baby. No woman should have to ever worry about, you know, be fearful. Am I going in here, you know, if my baby's going to live, or if I'm going to live, or am I going to get the best treatment? Am I going to be stressed? So I would say that I think it's just a genuine lack of care and just how they see us. And, you know, and it's unfortunate, but we have people that work in the medical field, that work in hospitals, and, you know, and they do not like us and don't care.
Right. My other question was, what is the response from men in your line of work? Like, do you see a lot of involvement from fathers and men in general?
Yes, I do. The men, they are more and more every day, they are coming more and more on board, and they are really seeing the value of it. For them, they're looking at the value of care for their wives, girlfriends, whatever their relationship is. And not only is this, I tell a lot of my clients, I explain to them that having a postpartum doula is not only for the mother, it's for the father too, because a lot of people neglect and they forget about the fathers. And so one of the things is that he has to come home too, and he has to, you know, deal with any mood swings or anything that his wife or girlfriend may be going through, and then remembering that he's not getting any sleep. So it's also beneficial for him, because not a lot of fathers get what they call paternity. So when he comes home, he has to go to work. He still got to provide for his family. So a lot of fathers are on board, because they're like, if I have a postpartum doula here to help my wife, I can sleep, and I can go to work and do what I need to do to provide for my family, and then she's here and she's well taken care of. So the men are definitely getting more on board once we explain it to them. You have a few of them that, you know, they either don't want to pay for it or they don't see a need of it, they don't see the value in it. But more and more every day, men are coming on board with it. You know, usually sometimes with the men, you know, they call. But they're like, I need a postpartum doula for, you know, my wife, because I want her to be well taken care of, and I want to make sure that she gets rest, that she heals, and that if she is going to go through postpartum depression, I want to have the measures in place to help her.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad to hear that, because just coming from my own personal perspective, a lot of these things I've never heard. As a matter of fact, all of the things that you said I've never heard. I'm just putting myself out there.
mm-hmm.
But it is an eye opener, man. It's it does give me a sense of appreciation and acknowledgement for the, I guess I could say, the structural racism that is built around targeting women. A lot of times we, you know, the conversation gets drowned out about, you know, what's happening to brothers in the street with police interactions and law enforcement. But a lot of times we don't get to hear about the mental health of women and the way that medical professionals treat them when they're getting ready to bring into the world a new life. So
right. This
is definitely opening my eyes to something that I can admit that I previously had not known about.
Right, and the work that the birth workers are doing, like Sister Tanya, the work that you all are doing, it is truly revolutionary. It's a way, it's a form of survival. It's necessary. Like, it's literally saving the lives of our moms and saving the lives of our babies by having this education and by having this support system. So we give thanks. We give thanks for all of the birth workers. We give thanks for you, sis. Really do.
Yeah.
Thank you. I absolutely enjoy what I do. I mean, it's definitely a passion of mine. And, you know, and one thing, you know, that I'll put out there, if you guys ever run across anybody that's pregnant or, you know, looking for postpartum doula, a lot of health insurance, they will cover that and pay for it. But I always tell my clients, if you have to ask, because, of course, it's not information they're going to volunteer. But there are people who have health insurance, and they will pay for it. They will pay for a labor doula. They will pay for postpartum. They will do those things. So, you know, you run across somebody, tell them to check that out.
Okay. And can you give some information on if somebody is listening, like if they would be interested in getting in contact with you? Do you have like an email address or something?
Yes, I do. My email address is Tanja, TANJA. GREENE, all one word, at yahoo.com. If you would like to get in touch with me and you're interested in knowing more information, interested in getting services, or if you're interested in becoming a postpartum doula, after January, I will be certified to actually teach the classes and teach ladies who are interested in becoming a postpartum doula, so I will be doing that as well. Please feel free to send me an email. And let me know, and we can, you know, definitely work it out, and I can give you all the information that you need. And even if you just want education, you have questions, email me, and I'll reach back out to you.
Okay. And I don't know how, I almost forgot the fact that you are an author. If you could tell us, and I definitely want to buy your book, if you can tell us a little about that and where we can buy your book.
Okay, sure. Yes, I am. An author as of June, and the name of the book is called BE Transform. It's an anthology, which is where you get a group of ladies together, and we all pour into a certain topic, so each person has a chapter. This book, BE Transform, it's an ultimate guide for real, relevant, and relational change to elevate your life. So basically what this book is it's 10 ladies, and we all tell our story of something that has happened in our life, and then give you steps of, if you got something going on in your life, we can break it down and give you steps on how to, you know, get out of that situation, what you need to transform your life, and what you need to do to get from the place that you consider a bad place to get to that better place in your life. So far we have, you know, just heard great things about the book. The stories are great. Like I say, each lady has their own experience, and you might see yourself in all of them, or you might see yourself in one of them, but it's really great information in that book. And if you would like to get the book, give me 1 second, and I will text it to you as well so that you'll have it, but you can cash app me at Becoming Miss Green, G-R-E-E-N-E, there's an E at the end of Green, Becoming, the dollar sign Becoming Miss Green, you can cash app me. The books are $25, and I definitely would appreciate, you know, your business and appreciate the support.
Okay, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me. This has been great.
I appreciate you coming on,
you do
giving
go
a lot
up,
of good information.
Yeah, I just wanted to say thank you, sister. I know that there's not a lot of people that's doing what you're doing, so I really do appreciate you being there for women and probably one of their most vulnerable moments and most precious moments as well. So thank you, man. All my honor to you, sister.
Thank you so much. I really do appreciate that.
All right. Thank you, sis. Thank you again for joining us. So
thank you for your hard work and dedication.
Thank you. I'm going to mute your line, sis. And so now the next sister that we want to bring on is one of our sisters. She is in the National Black United Front Kansas City chapter. We met her a few years back, and she's a very hard-working, dedicated, beautiful sister, and she does a lot. I'm not sure she'll tell us her exact role in the Kansas City chapter, but I know that the sister works very hard, and I'm so happy to have her come on tonight and be a guest speaker and discuss the racial disparities in foster care and the need for more black foster parents. I know she recently became a foster parent. That's something that my heart is longing to do. So when I saw that she was doing that, I was like, yes, sis, we got to talk about it. We got to hear you on the show. So I'm going to unmute her line in 1 second. Let me find it. Hold on. All right. Sis, your line should be open, Sister Tashia.
Peace, love, and Black Power, family.
No, peace, love, and Black Power.
Peace, love, and Black Power. It's so good to be on the line with you guys today. And I've been listening to the conversation, and, man, both topics are so needed in our community. So I want to thank you guys, first and foremost, for allowing us one, as sisters to come on and speak about this, but two, to talk about these issues for our community.
Yes.
So to everyone who's listening, my name is Tashia Richards. Like Sister Ruth said, we are in the National Black United Front in the Kansas City chapter. I am the chairperson. I'm the chairwoman. In addition to that, I wear many hats. And so not only am I the chairperson of our local chapter here, I do work in corporate America full-time. I run a nonprofit called SisStars, Helping SisStars, where we help women get back into the community, as well as have a small business. And I'm a foster parent. I've been a foster parent for just about 5 months now, but I've been licensed for 20 years. And let me just tell you, I didn't think that I was ready. Even now, I didn't think that I was ready. But what made me want to become a foster parent was I was sitting up one day watching the news, and there was an influx of stories about white families adopting our children. And if you know anything about the foster care system, a lot of our children don't have positive experiences. And those who end up in foster care are there, you know, already from broken homes and experiences of trauma, and of and if they are fortunate enough to end up in a foster home versus ending up in a group home, or even end up being homeless, then those statistics go way down. We have about 23% of our children who are in foster care each year, but the number that's adopted is way less than that. And so it just broke my heart seeing these young people not being able to hold on to a little piece of themselves. And when I say that, I'm talking about culture. They're growing up in an environment. And, yes, we all should be about diversity and the what the world needs now is love. And, you know, as long as someone is taking care of the children, that's all good and dandy. But we need people who look like us to take care of our own children and our own community. And that's what prompted me to just say, you know what, it's time. After 20 years, it is time for me to do my part in saving my community. And I activated my license. So that in a nutshell is the story about how I got involved. And when I sit in classes or I go through the training or I see other foster parents, most likely, oftentimes, I am the only black face in the room. And to be a black woman is one thing, but you hardly ever see brothers who are foster parents. I never thought that at this age I would be a single parent, but it is the greatest thing to at least be a parent to, you know, children who need you. I don't have any biological children, and so this was definitely an overnight experience. But, you know, looking out, a lot of people are like, well, you can't do this. There's a lot of chatter in our community about, you know, not being confident enough to provide for our children in need. And let me tell you, it doesn't take a lot. It just takes a heart that's willing to love and being willing to be open to sharing your home and your experiences with these young people. Because the experience that I've had, and the experience that I hear about what my young people have had has just it's definitely been a journey. I got one young lady, my first placement. I decided to take teen girls, and she was 17 and she had a 18-month-old son. And so overnight I became a grandmother as well as a mother. And but hearing her story, she had been in over 50 foster homes, and those homes didn't look like us. And so they labeled her. So you know, she was labeled as hostile, as confrontational. She was told, you know, that she couldn't get along with people. I heard stories about you couldn't have any other teens in the house with her. No other children. When she came across, all of these things was happening, but it said she's a good mother. And I was like, you know, scratching my head, like, are you sure? And immediately when I met her, we clicked. And we both realized that it was a cultural thing. It had nothing to do with, you know, the fact that she had an attitude or the fact that she was yelling and cussing people out. It was straight cultural. Knowing that you are in an environment with people who look like you, who care about you because of who you actually are, who are able to deal with you on your level. I mean, how many black women have you heard got attitude problems, or we are confrontational, or we loud, you know? So
right.
You take that. You take that. And
like,
you
look at yourself.
But really take that and look at yourself, and we know how to deal with that. Black mothers, black sisters, black grandmothers, black aunties, we know how to deal with that kind of stuff. It's not,
that's right.
We're not going to label our children because they blow up or because they're a little bit loud or because, I mean, the world does that enough to them. And so with this little sister, that's exactly what it was. It was a cultural thing. And immediately it was like, listen, there's a way that we can do this. And you are in a place that, one, we straight black power over here. So, you know,
that's
there's
right.
a lot of cultural things that you're going to learn.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of things that you can experience in your life that, you know, she had never experienced before. And just something simple as moving into a black home from a white home made a world of difference in, you know, the confidence that our children have. And I see it every day. I see our children, you know, who are with parents that don't look like them. And, you know, they you know, you can tell when a child is loved, don't get me wrong. But you can also tell when a child is confident in themselves. And what we can offer our children is more than just a home, and it's more than just a safe place. It's that confidence in knowing that, you know, I'm a African child, I'm a black child, you know, I have a family who loves me, and I'm able to be myself. I don't have to wear a mask. And I listen to the stories. I read about the stories all the time, and I talk to my girls. I have teenage girls. We talk about these issues, and it's just amazing the things that they've gone through, and it's amazing how far they've grown even since they've been in my, you know, since I've been in their presence, not them being in mine, me being in their presence. Uh-huh. And so even thinking about my friends and my family, I'm like, y'all, we got to do this. We got to save our own community. Do our part. And that's one of the things we can do in addition to mentoring and being a big brother or being a big sister. If you have the ability and you have that capacity, why don't you think about taking in some of these children and giving them something that's greater than what the system can give them? And so,
right.
Right. I'm listening to first of all, sister, thank you for all that you do. Next time you introduce yourself, you should say you're a Renaissance woman because you do it all. So listening to what you said, there's a few things that jumped out at me. You know, already crushed one of my questions for you in reference to how many brothers you've encountered speaking to, you know, foster children. But it's I do want to comment on a young sister's, you know, quote unquote attitude. It's easy for these institutions and white people specifically to label an attitude as being threatening or offensive, and it's a lot harder for them to see that as a manifestation of that child's reaction to their environment. You know, a lot of times we underestimate how young people feel their environment, you know what I'm saying, as opposed to not necessarily understanding it, but they can feel that it's not an environment that they should be in. And yeah, we definitely should not be chastising them for lashing out in those environments, understanding that a lot of the times they have all the right in the world to do so. But listening to your experience of being a foster mother, that's the telling Sister Rue a couple of days ago that I was going to share this about my mother. My mother was a foster mother of four, two sets of brothers separately. And when you said that you wanted to contribute, you know, to what I perceive as the survival of us as a nation of people, I can say that I've seen it work. So hearing you say that you making it work and playing your part, that is definitely an honorable thing to do. My mother, she the first two young boys she had, I never forget them, Dominic and Leroy. Right? We all love Leroy. Not to say we didn't like Dominic, but Leroy was just precious, right? So, but yeah, their mother was, you know, hooked on drugs, and I guess that the judicial system took, you know, her children from her under the condition that she get herself together. But long story short, she got herself together, and as a result of that, her and my mother developed a very close relationship with each other. And seeing that, you know, at least looking back on it now, I can see that two people who had not known each other before developed a bond, and out of that grew, you know, at least a larger, you know, community, family of women who are being involved in raising our children, as opposed to letting the system, you know, I don't even want to say raise them, but just do whatever they feel like they want to do with them. So, yeah, man, I love the fact that you're doing that, and I love the fact that you most certainly are educating that sister in Black Power. So, yeah, keep it up. Before I finish there, have you never seen a brother involved in this process?
Oh no, I can't say that. I have a friends. We didn't go to the same high school, but we're, you know, classmates. And he and his family are foster parents. So yes, I see that brother. Now in my class, I was in there with one other brother and one sister, and I'm talking about a class of about 60. And it was three of us in there. And then something else I will say is, when you look even in the foster care system, or you look around our children in need, you hardly ever see any Asian children. You don't see any Indian children or Arab children. And it makes you wonder, why is it that we don't? Now, the first thing that comes to my mind is that they take care of their own community. So if mama can't take care of them, you know, they're going to extended families. And so I began to wonder and think about that, you know, why extended families don't do that. Now, I know in my continental African communities, something happens to you, then that goes to the eldest son, or it goes, you know, that responsibility goes on to that, you know, that eldest person to take care of the family. So you actually don't see a lot of continental African children as well, but African American children, or I should say, you know, Africans living in America, and our children, you know, end up in the system for multiple reasons. And the number one reason I hear is because people say, I can't afford to take on any more responsibility. I can't afford to take on any more kids. And that's sad that we would, you know, we can't afford to take on our nieces and our nephews and our grandchildren like we used to. And I will say this, foster care does provide a stipend for the families. I also will say Missouri, where I live, is the lowest foster care state that there is in the whole country. So when they are talking about a stipend for taking care of housing and food and clothing, it's not even comparable to what, you know, our children even need. So I understand when they say that, but at the same time, if you are in a position to where you can provide, then do so. And find those resources within the system to help you out where you cannot. I have one child, and she was notorious for telling people, you just in it for the money. I'm like, honey, that is not the case. And when she found out that I wasn't in it for the money and I was in it for the love of her, I mean, we became best friends. I mean, it just, things totally changed. But you have some people who do abuse the system. You have people who take advantage of our children, and you have people who are in it for the wrong reasons. And like, you know, I say I advocate for it here in our city, and we have online support groups and things of that nature. Don't let not being able, or your idea of not being able to care for children, deter you away. Because from 0 to 21, I know in this state they can stay in the system until they're 21. Our young people need us.
Mm-hmm.
And there are resources out there to help you along the way. Now, let me tell you how big my village is. Now, the sisters know the Black United Front here in Kansas City is big, and we are a family. So I have all of them. And when I tell you all of them brothers will step up and do whatever I need them to help me with, all of the sisters with these young queens, I have people in the community that's just like, hey, I hear you're a foster parent. Let me help you out. People at my place of employment, it's like, hey, whatever we need to do, people get it. There are people who get it. We just need our people to get it. And go out there and be a support system. If you can't support young people yourself, be a support system for people who can. And it can be as easy as an ear at night. There's plenty of nights I was so frustrated. I didn't want to blow up on these young these girls. I did not want them to see me cry. I did not want them to see me frustrated or, you know, confused. And so you go to your support system. And the same thing with them. I let them know, if you can't come talk to me, you got a support system. They had to see for themselves that they had a village, a community that was here for them. And, you know, and that's what we can be. If you don't find yourself in that position right now to take on a foster care system or to take, you know, foster kids in, then be a support system for someone who can't. And I wanted to just take a second to talk about some of the process that you can go through to be a foster parent. So if you are interested in becoming a foster parent, the first thing that you will want to do is reach out to your state's children's family or family and children's services. Each city, they call it something different. It's DFS, DCF, whatever it ends up being. Reach out to them. Their website should have something on there about foster families. And you normally will fill out an application. Somebody gets back with you, and then they will send you through training. So the training here in Missouri, I've been licensed in both Kansas and Missouri. The training is about 10 weeks or 10 courses. They work around your schedule sometimes. There are set classes that's out there. They have organizations who give you the proper training on how to deal with our children who have been through trauma. And when I tell you our children have been through trauma, they've been through sexual trauma, emotional trauma, physical trauma. They've been homeless. In addition to being abused, they've been abandoned. They have been miseducated. And we already know before they even got into the system, they are already living in trauma itself. So they have so many things that have happened to them. And so you have to have that training to know how to deal with a child who comes home and is feeling emotional from a bad day at school or a parent not showing up to their visit or just knowing that they're different than everybody else that's in the household. So they send you through that training, and they'll give you the basics at least. You can join support groups that's out there. You will get a licensed worker who will tell you everything that you need in your home. Basically, you need for them to have their own place to sleep, in their own room. If you have multiple children, they can be in the room together as long as they have their own bed. Some siblings can even sleep in the same bed together. A place for them to put their clothes, of course. And you have to have, you know, transportation, somewhere where you can transport the children. So those are like some of the basic requirements that you need. In addition to that, the system does, depending on where you are in the state or in the country, some systems help you out with clothing. Some help you out with food. Some, they do give you the stipend for the children. And depending on what age they are, you would get different amounts. They help you with child care. Younger children, they pay for the before and after school program. So don't think, you know, I work at 8 to 5. These children are only going to school from 8 to 3. What am I going to do? I can't do it. They have resources out there for you. They have resources to help these teen mothers. They have resources to help you know, children get a job and things of that nature. So there's a lot of resources out there for you if you are interested in getting involved in the foster care system. And I'm not saying it's the greatest. Dealing with these people, our workers are overloaded. They are worked hard. Their caseload is greater than the people who are willing to be caseworkers and social workers and doctors and all of this. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't trade it for the world at this point. I mean, it's well worth it knowing that I'm able to do my little piece. And when I tell you it's a little piece, because I would love to open a foster home with 100 beds and help all the children that I possibly can, this is just a little piece that I feel that I can do to help my community and help my people.
Right. And if we all just did, you know, if we all contributed our little that way, it would mean everything. I was just looking online where it was saying that 60% of child sex trafficking victims come out of either foster or group homes. So they definitely need us because they're getting into the wrong hands and they being exploited and abused. Mm-hmm. So it's like that is a viable solution for us to be becoming foster parents, because, like, we can talk all day long about black power, and we can talk about all the political education and everything else that we want to talk about, black economics, black spirituality. We can talk about all of that. But if we're not even getting our children, we're not even saving our children, like, what are we doing?
Exactly. Absolutely.
So that's something that I'm
going to
be working on soon. Yeah. Something I'm going to be working on myself soon.
Well, I was going to ask a question, Sister Chachi. Peace and love, and thank you for all that you do. I want to say that to you first. And I admire you for doing that. Now, I already have children, right, my own. And that was one of my fears, you know, how would I be able to maintain or do that, you know, seeing that I already have children, you know, do they allow that? That was one of the questions that held me back from actually moving forward. How does that work when you already have, you know, a family or a single parent? How does that work?
You know, it pretty much is the same. They don't really draw a line in the sand. If you have the right in the right environment to be a foster parent, you could be a foster parent. If you have children, then that's totally okay. Now, some states have guidelines to where they have a maximum number of children that you can have in your home. So say you have 5 children, and maybe you can only get 5 foster children because there's a maximum of 10 children. Sorry, I hear a lot of feedback. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
But even so, then whether you have your own children or you're a single parent, don't let that stop you. The opportunity still exists.
Okay. And then I know earlier you were saying something in regards to the young lady, how they look at our children as having attitudes and things of that nature. I just want to say, being a mom, I don't think it's just that the youth have attitudes. That's how they express themselves. Some of our babies are a little more aggressive depending on the situations that they're in. But I see it doing the work that I do all the time where there are white families that have our children. And then, you know, they're taking them to counseling, and I'm in having conversations with them. And I just say to the children how beautiful they are, you know, just talking to them. And then I had one white guy say to me, because I thought it was his child, because the baby girl looked mixed, right? So I said, is that your daughter? He said, no, they're foster children. So, and I said, well, you know, I thought that she was your daughter. He said, well, she would really love that. She would want to belong. And I'm like, what do you mean she would want to belong? She do belong. She's with you. You know, so when you said earlier, you know, we need to have our babies, and we need to take that initiative to take care of them and to be there for them, I wholeheartedly agree. because I got real offended this year going to these counseling mental health sessions to see these white people bring our babies in. And then they say things like that. And I'm just like, what do you mean she wants to belong? She should belong. You know, you got her. So what are you doing? Is she just something to do? You know, those are the questions that run through my mind. So I wholeheartedly agree with you there when you say we need to get on board and we need to take that initiative and take care of our community. And,
absolutely.
I know a young lady that is interested. She doesn't have children, but she has, like, a criminal record. Do you think that that would, like, prevent her because she has, like, a – it's old. I think it's maybe about 4 or 5 years old. You know, she's a convicted felon, but that's one of her passions. She wants to be a foster mom, but that's one of her reasons why. Do you suggest that she move forward and talk to the community, the people that's in charge, to see if that's, you know, even an option for her?
Yes. First, I would suggest that she finds out what the state law is. In some states, you can't have a felony at all. In other states, you can't have a sex crime conviction, which definitely makes sense. But you can be a felon.
Oh, no,
and, you know, these days they're putting a felony on us quicker than anything. So I would say check the law and see what it says. And inquire, you know, let her speak personally with a licensed professional. Here they call licensing workers, so that she can know exactly what she needs. Because they're going to do a background check. They're going to run your fingerprint. They're going to ask for references. That they are going to pry into your background. They're going to ask you, how was your childhood? How did you resolve issues with your parents? How did you resolve conflict with your friends and your coworkers? And at the end of the day, what they really are just trying to make certain is, are you going to be able to handle the children? Are you going to be able to deal with their conflicts in a way that is going to be productive? And do you have a support system surrounding you? And even if you don't, because I had people tell me, girl, and I'm telling you, I was licensed for 20 years now. So I had friends that was like, you ain't got time. We trying to travel. We trying to live it up. We doing this. You know, I didn't travel through the world. We have, you know, you do things and you just figure I'll just do it later, or I don't have time right now, or, you know, you get busy, or you have people who are the influencers in your life. If this is something that you feel that you want to do, do it for you, because it's going to be evident in these young people's lives when you are doing it for you and you're doing it out of love and you're not just doing it for a paycheck. Like that man, when you tell me that he's like, this is a foster child, the only time that I will say that is when I have to clarify, because I might not have the proper paperwork, or I might not have all the information on my children. But these are my children. These are my girls, my daughters. And they need to feel like they're my daughters, that I'm their mother, that I'm going to take care of them like they were my biological children. My grandson needs to know that there's no difference between his mother being a foster child or being a biological child. They never are going to know that difference. And so it hurts me when I see people do that, you know.
I feel like it's all a sense of belonging, you know. When we are with adults and our peers, and we all, you know, we are connected on one accord, you know, that's what makes life a little bit more, to me, easier when we have that support system, as you were saying. And then when that, we have our little people that can identify, you know, with a black mother or a black woman. You know, to me, I feel like it's more understanding there, and the likelihood of them uprising from where they are and the state of mind that they are in and feeling, you know, abandoned or whatever they've been through. I feel like the likelihood of having a black mother before them, or that black mother or father figure before them helped to break them, you know. So, and I agree 100% all the way around with you. We need to get on board and take initiative and to take our community back.
I said that.
Now, if others would like to talk to you on more of a personal note, Tati, could you give them a point of contact for yourself so that they can, you know, contact you, whether it's by email or through a cell phone number or whichever way, you know, we could contact you? Would you be able to, would you like to share that with them right now?
Absolutely. So I know social media is big these days, and because I have older girls, we do a lot on social media. So you can catch us on pretty much all the platforms at Tati I Am Divine. That is TatiIAmDivine. If you want to email me for more information, and I'll tell you any information I get, I am willing to share. My email address is the number one, love, L-O-V-E, the number two, foster, F-O-S-T-E-R, the number three, at gmail.com. And listen, I understand that people need an ear. I had to call my friend who was another foster parent and had to vent and eventually cry and wipe those tears and be encouraged. And it's going to be some rough times. It's going to be some fabulous times. And it's going to be some times where you just need someone else to talk to who knows your exact experience. And you are welcome to give me a call. My number, and this is a business number, so you may have to leave a message, but I promise I'll get right back with you. The number is 816-866-6055. And I can be reached any way there is. If you're on social media, I normally answer right away. But you can call and text that number as well, and I'll be certain to be there for you. And if we don't have resources in your city, let's help find those resources because they're there. And one thing that I learned is the people who are using them, they typically don't share them because they feel like, okay, I got this, and I don't want to let a good thing go bad. But when it comes to us, we need to share as many resources to help save our children, save our community, save our people as possible. So I don't think like that. Whatever I have, you can get it too. Whether number, email address, or we're going to show up in a meeting or whatever it is, we're going to utilize these resources for our benefit.
Right.
Well, I thank you for giving everyone your point of contact to Tati. And again, I thank you and the other sister, and I thank our brother on the line for sharing such powerful and impactful information with our listeners. Again, I can't express my gratitude for all of the wealth of knowledge that we've been shown here on today. And before I close out, I'd like to thank you, Sister Sharonda, as well, for always being that support system for myself and the things that we're growing and doing together in our community. And if you all are free on tomorrow night, there is the George Jackson University show that is live at the same time with the same call-in number. So if you would be so kind of join in on tomorrow night, we would love to have you and supporting our Black community. And I want to thank you again, everyone, for tuning in. And peace and Black power and Black August salute. We love you. Peace and love.
Have a great
Black Power.
Black Power. Peace.